my name is Ray O'Keefe. I'm an alcoholic. I suppose they asked me to come down here because I've been in AA a long time. You can tell by looking at me, I've been someplace for a long time. When I was sober about a week, my sponsor gave me this book. He didn't give me this book. He gave me a book very much like this book. And he said, read the black part here. Don't read the white part, and don't read in between the black part, and you'll be all right. Just read that black part. And the black part says, when speaking, we tell what we were like, what happened, and what we are like now. And a lot of people get that wrong. They say they think it says, tell us what it was like. Well, it doesn't say that. And you don't want to know what it was like anyhow, do you? It was for you. It was crap, is what it was. Well, what I was like is a totally different thing. Little rascal. So anyhow, what we just give our background. Now, I was born and I grew up, or at least I got a little taller, in one of the neighborhoods in New York City. My neighborhood was in the Bronx. The home of the New York Yankees. I live right around the corner from Yankee Stadium. I could walk in there and I watched Lou Gehrig and all those guys play baseball. Anyhow, I lived in an Irish neighborhood and they drank in that neighborhood. Oh, yes, they did. And one would see people on the street under the influence of alcohol. Oh, yes. And I just found out about 5 years ago, and this had a lot to do with it, I just found out that I'm from a dysfunctional family. But it's all right, I talked it over with my inner child, and we got in touch with my emotions and resolved all of the issues. Now that we have that horse shit out of the way, we get on with AA now. Try a little AA. So if you looked where I lived, you see a little drinking. My mother, the widow O'Keefe, was known to take a drink from time to time. And if the pressure got on, Kitty would go for the light wines and the spirits, and something would fly, usually one of the children. My brother Billy, on the other hand, was a very bad drinker, and in a neighborhood of Irish drunks, Billy O'Keefe stood out. So when I showed up at the local institution and ordered up whatever it was they were serving 13-year-olds that afternoon, nobody paid any attention to me. It was just another O'Keefe, and give him a drink, and let's get on with it. And I don't remember what they gave me. I suspect it was a beer. That's what we drank. But whatever it was, I loved it. I liked everything about it. I liked the way it looked. I liked the way it smelled. I liked the way it tastes. I liked what it did for my head. I liked the noise, the smoke, the fist fights, the Irish music, the bullshit. I loved it. And I went after it with a great passion for the next many years, and here I am. I was going through the parochial school system, in a manner of speaking. Where else would someone named O'Keefe go to school? A lot of people knock the Catholic school system. I do not. They instructed me well. They gave me a good education free. And of course, they saved me from going blind. And and that's a big item. You don't want to forget that. I had a lot of trouble in school with these people. I was thrown out of high school a number of times. I held the neighborhood record for being thrown out of high school, a record previously established by my brother Billy. How it happened, I really, to this day, I'm not sure. I really don't know how it happened, but I was given a scholarship to a college, and a college was in the great state of Vermont. And that's a lot different than the Bronx. There were no, in those days, there were no bars in the state of Vermont. If you drank, you sat at a table, you drank beer out of a bottle. So up I went and I arrived, and these people sat around tables drinking beer out of bottles. They sang these dopey college songs. They wore white shoes in the wintertime. Being a man of no particular moral fiber, I got a pair of white shoes. And I learned the words to some of those dopey songs, you know, college songs. Well, I went around for a while, and pretty soon I was in trouble with the school. I was in trouble with my girlfriend. I was in trouble at home. I was in trouble with a couple of teachers. I was in trouble with the guys I live with. And so I did a sensible thing. I got a haircut, and I joined the Navy. And about 6 months later, I was in the South Pacific on a minesweeper. And we were blowing up the ocean, and it was raining dead fish in my head. And I thought to myself, this may not be it either. My search for serenity, this may not be the place. But I came back from the service, went back to school, and I arrived in the middle of a blizzard in January. And there they were. Nobody had left. They were all sitting around the same table, drinking the same beer, singing the same songs, wearing the same shoes. And now a grateful government was giving me money every month, and that's a wonderful thing. And so I was moderately solvent all the time, and therefore drunk most of the time. And college is a big blur. I have no recollection of it, really. But I was staring around the campus one day in my usual shape, and I saw a list of names on the bulletin board, people who were qualified to graduate. And my name was on the list. And that was excellent news. I thought I had another year to go. So I called home and I notified the widow of this great event, and up she came. And oh, what a tender occasion that was. The widow and her youngest child staggering around under the elms. It would bring tears to a stone. Some years later, when I became rich and famous, I was a trustee of that school, and I'd go to meetings, and they were still talking about my mother. It isn't that often in the state of Vermont they see a little old lady get off a train drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning and start a fight with the baggage guy. So the question was what to do. My uncles, who ran the family, my father died when I was two, so my uncles, it's an Irish family, the uncles ran it, and they had voted unanimously that I become a New York City policeman. And that's what my father had done, that's what one of my brother had done. And that's what they all did. Everybody, all my uncles and cousins were all cops, except for the two morons that work for the phone company. So I told them I had received a scholarship to law school, and I wasn't going to be a cop. And so right away they knew there was nothing worthwhile about me. So I went off to law school, and I never met a lawyer before I went to law school. We had no lawyers in my neighborhood. We had cops and we had priests. We really didn't need lawyers for anything at all. I hate to be disloyal to the profession, but I must tell you, when I got to law school, I was in the company of the greatest collection of stiffs that had ever assembled under one roof. Oh, they were deadly. They all had on a blue suit and they wore eyeglasses. So I went out and got a pair of glasses. I didn't need glasses, I got a pair of glasses. And I had a blue suit and I fit right in. And I went on a wagon, because they scared the life out of you in law school. And I listened to that first lecture and I said, oh. So I went on a wagon. It was not difficult. They just stopped, said, hell with this. And I drank Summers. And as a result of going on the wagon, I did very well in law school. I was a very good student. And as a result of that, when I graduated law school, I was taken into a large, white, Anglo-Saxon, Wall Street, Protestant law firm. They hired me as sort of the resident immigrant. It was not a total loss, however. I did learn to say, oh, really, instead of no shit. I said, oh, really? Oh, that's very nice. My superiors there determined I should be trained as a trial lawyer, and so they sent me up to the courthouse in New York City to learn my business, and I was only there a matter of moments when I discovered that all the really smart guys were across the street in a bar. So I moved my whole operation into the saloon, and I learned to drink in a different way, civilized, the way lawyers drink. I learned to drink it scotch in a tall glass with ice. You sip on that, it's very genteel. I discovered all of the mysteries and all of the rituals of the very, very dry martini. And to this evening and to this moment, my love, my admiration, and my affection for the very, very dry martini is surely the greatest case of unrequited love the world has ever seen. I was so loyal, and they almost killed me. It was time in my natural development that I be married, and I had located this lady, or she had located me. Who knows how these things happen? I was working as a bellhop in a hotel, and she was a guest, and I carried her luggage, and that pretty well characterizes the relationship right now. Ms. O'Keefe, my wife, I usually call her my current wife. I find it keeps her on her toes. She's been current for 46 years, so there's hope, there's hope. Ms. O'Keefe is from a totally different background than mine. She's a lady raised in a beautiful home with parents and a fence and a dog, and oh dear. I will not burden you with the details of my wedding day, but I assure you that when the O'Keefes from the South Bronx hit the Westchester Country Club, they set a few records. My Uncle Bernie hit a waiter, and we settled down and set up housekeeping and all of that stuff. And Ms. O'Keefe began to produce children with the regularity that is known only to the Roman Catholic. She popped a kid out of there every spring, boy. Now they're all around me, I don't know. And after we date everything by the children, after about the second kid, I think it was, I received a phone call from, I went to the Fordham University School of Law in New York City, big Jesuit law school. And I received a call from the dean to go see him. So I went to see the dean, and he appointed me to the faculty. Imagine that. And I became Professor O'Keefe. How do you do? And I scared to death. I was scared to death. What the hell? The last thing in my mind, and I couldn't imagine anything in my background. Get this. So once again, I decided I knew I drank too much. I always drank too much. Everybody I knew drank too much. So like I didn't ask, I'm going to stop now because I'm nervous about this job, but I couldn't stop. I cut down. I didn't drink quite as much. You know, I drank more when I was drinking less than when I was drinking more, because when I drank less, I got so goddamn nervous, I had to drink more so I could drink less so I wouldn't get fired for drinking more. Does that make sense? Yeah. But the way that worked out, about three years later, it turned out I was a good teacher. I was a competent law teacher. And once I found that out, there was no point in trying to control my drinking. And I wasn't doing so good anyhow. And I had an older brother, Billy, 4 years older. You're not taking us to be brothers. He was a poster Marine. That's what he was. He was a United States Marine, 30 years. And I did everything like Billy. I couldn't. I wasn't an athlete or anything. So, but I tried to do everything like Billy. I drank like Billy. Billy drank until he fell down, or the building went on fire, or the cops arrived, or something happened to interfere with it. Maybe five kids, maybe more. A lot of kids. They're all over the house. You see them around. Noisy little bastard. And this time, too, Miss O'Keefe began to talk ugly about me. She became disloyal. Yes, she did, very disloyal. And she said there was something radically wrong with the way I drank. She's not a lawyer. She does not have the benefit of a legal education. And I'm kind, I explain things to her because of that. And besides that, her mother was never right. I don't want to say any more about that, but her mother was not right. So I will explain to her, see how you handle this. I would explain to her the relativity of drinking. Which is to say that some people drink more than other people. Are we all right here now? And I would explain that to her, and I say, I don't drink that much on a relative scale. As a matter of fact, I don't drink as much as my mother. And she would say, nobody drinks as much. What is a person to do now? She's insulted my mother. I can't, you know. So this drove her crazy, literally, and she betook herself to her physician, who, as you might imagine, is an obstetrician. And he couldn't find anything the matter with her until she told him about me, an act of disloyalty. And he immediately sent her home to me with a message. The message was that I was an alcoholic and I should go to AA. I am one of the few men in Alcoholics Anonymous who comes here upon the advice of a gynecologist. I was very upset when she told me that, and I rose, as is my custom, to defend myself, and I took a very dim view, as you would too, of a physician who would make a diagnosis of a patient without ever seeing the patient, without laying eyes. How would they do such a thing? And then, of course, I went into the sorry state of the medical profession generally, and I asked her a question to which she not yet discovered the answer. I asked her what kind of a man became an obstetrician in the first place. You got it. At this point, the conversation was coming downhill rapidly, and then it happened. I don't know how this happened. It happened. I cannot explain to you how this happened. I can explain many, many other things to you, which I probably will do in the second or third hour of this terrific talk I am giving. But in the middle of all of my yelling and ranting and raving, I stopped and I admitted to Mrs. O'Keefe, for the first time I'd ever admitted to anyone, oh, this is so painful to remember, that there was at least the possibility that I had on several occasions, permitted myself to be overserved. Mrs. O'Keefe, Bill Martin knows her. Mrs. O'Keefe is a woman of great resource. She sprang into action. 3 days later, I was a prisoner in a mental institution in Stanford, Connecticut. And I was only there a matter of moments when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side of the door. And there was some guy peeping through the hole in the door. And in addition to everything so terrible that was going on, it also happened to be the occasion of my 35th birthday. And I mentioned this to some bozo in a white suit who was hovering around. I explained to this cretin that on this very day I had attained age 35, and therefore, under the Constitution of the United States of America, I was eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaigns. He said there were two other presidents living in the place. These were happier times. There were no alcoholics allowed in hospitals. There were no rehabilitation centers. There were no 28 goddamn stupid programs. There were no alcoholism counselors. There were loony bins for guys like me. So I was playing Monopoly all day and all night with three guys who were there, and they weren't alcoholics, they were just there. And we played a lot of Monopoly, and one of them was under the impression that I was his real estate broker. So if you know anything about the game of Monopoly and some nut thinks you're his real estate broker, you do pretty good, you know? I had the boardwalk, I had a number of houses, some hotels, and I was not drinking. And I was not thinking of drinking. The Monopoly therapy was working. I was thinking about playing Monopoly all day and all night. And in the middle of one of the games, a guy came in and he said, "You have a visitor." Nobody's visiting me. I went to my large executive type padded cell and waited for the visitor. And in comes this guy in a suit, shirt, tie, very imposing. Announces he's from the Darien, Connecticut group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the hospital has given up on me. I won't go to occupational therapy. I keep asking for copper tubing, you know, they. And I reverted to type. I started at him. You know, a very rude man. You know what he said to me? You won't believe this. Listen to what he said to me. He said to me this: "Shut up." Just like that. Well, I knew that they had forgotten to tell him who I was. So I started to give him a little biographical background, and he told me to sit down and shut up. Very rude. But he was very imposing, and I was not well. And he poured out this story to me, and amazing what he said, how close it was to me. And he said, "Would you like to go with me to meetings?" Meetings? What kind of meetings? He said, "Meetings of alcoholics." "Oh, please, I really don't. That's not possible. I have no reason to go there." "Oh, where are these meetings?" He said, "They're outside." I said, "I'm going with you." And that's how it began. He took me out, and then off we went. And he made arrangements for me to go locally, and I came back. I lived in a town called Larchmont, New York, and very upscale. I'm not going to take you through it. It still makes the hair on the back of my neck go up, and it was so miserable. But it lasted, and I would drink a week, then I wouldn't drink a month. I'd drink a month, I wouldn't drink a week. I would drink, go to the meetings, I'd go to the meetings, and I would drink. Things began to happen to me in this time that had not happened to me before. And I'm not talking to you now, things that happened to me in this period of time that I did consider to be significant. I was fired as a tenured full professor of law, the youngest one in the United States, fired. I was in serious, I mean very serious, personal, professional, and financial difficulties. And I had lost the affection of everybody who was around me. And for the last period of time drinking, I pretty much lived in a car. All of this happened, but this is not what I'm talking to you about. What I now understand was happening to me is that there seemed to be in my case, and perhaps in yours, a terrible, terrible disintegration of my spirit. That spirit which makes me different than each of you. That spirit which gives me whatever individuality or personality or character that I might have. And this was the spirit which once burned in me so bright. And it was practically extinguished, and I knew it. and there wasn't a thing in the world that I could do about it. And as I sit here and tell you, I did not think I would ever be able to stop drinking. I just didn't think so. I didn't think it was going to happen. Sad. I thought that was very sad, but that's the way it was. And so I continued to drink. And then one day, my time came. My time came. I don't know any more about this than anybody in this room, but it does seem to me that there is a time for all of us, and there is a time for each of us. And I say to you, there's a line there somewhere beyond which we are simply not permitted to go. And it seems to me there's a point somewhere below which we just are not allowed to sink. And there's also, I think, a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required to endure. Now, of course, I don't know where this would be for you. How would I know such a thing? I only know what happened to me. And I think it is a personal and it's an individual thing. And it's different in each case. And in some cases, it may be death. And that's the way it was for my brother Billy. They call one night from the Veterans Hospital in Minneapolis and to tell me that my brother was dead from alcoholism. And he had collapsed in the street, and they brought him in to the vets, and he died. And so my brother, my hero, died the way alcoholics oftentimes do, without friends, without family. And he was a long, long way from our neighborhood in the Bronx. But I'll tell you this, my brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. He's finished drinking. Now, for other people, it can be something trivial, but that line is there somewhere. And I came to it, and I didn't know that it was going to be my last day of drinking. It was November 24th, 1965. I had no idea that would be the day that I would stop drinking. I was in this, I had gotten a place to be, I was still a lawyer. I wasn't a law professor, I was still a lawyer. And I'd gotten a place to be a lawyer. Some classmates of mine let me stay in this place. And I had made a lot of money that day. And I had a handful of money. And there was a bar in the lobby of the building. So I had a decision to make. And I called up a man who's my sponsor, his name is John. And I talk about him a lot. And I told him what was happening, and of course he came over to see me. And God, he looked good. And I felt so bad, and I told him, I'm not doing well here. What should I do? You know that look that sponsors have? He gave me one of those looks, and he said, don't drink and go to the meetings, you'll be fine. I said, you see, you know, I don't know why I bother with you. You have no idea what the hell is going on here. The real problem is this place where I'm trying to work. This is no place for me. I'm too good a lawyer to be in this dump. Yeah, he said, well, if you don't drink and you go to the meetings, you'll probably get a better place to work. I said, well, at home it's worse, you know. I'm not even allowed to go up there anymore. Yeah, he said, well, what the hell? All those kids, you stop drinking, go to the meetings, you'll probably get back in up there. Oh, I said, well, you know, I'm being sued by a bank. He said, yeah, I read about it. Yeah, he said, well, he said, you can settle a case like that. That's easy. Just don't drink. You go to the meetings, you'll be fine. I sensed that there was no dialogue in there. And so did he, I think, because he said, come on, you're not doing anything. Let's go. So he made a phone call or so, and he took me over to Grand Central Station. He stuck me on a train going up to Larchmont. It's about a 40-minute ride. And halfway up, I reconsidered, you know. What the hell am I calling this moron? You know, don't drink, my ass. Wait till this train stops. I show you don't drink. And that's my attitude. I get off the train, and standing on the platform of the station was the guy who delivered the mail to my house. His name is Al. He was chairman of the local AA group, Al. Al says, get in the car. I said, Al, you're a nice guy, but I don't hang out with mailmen. He says, somebody called me about you. Get in the car. So I can't have a fistfight with a mailman or anybody else for that matter. So I get in Al's car, and he says, la, 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 don't drink, go to a meeting, same old crap. And he took me up to the AA meeting. It was a Wednesday night. He took me up there, and I didn't drink that day, and I haven't had a drink since. That's very instructive. You know, my wife of so many years, even if she has no affection for me, she certainly has a lot of affection for her children. She begged me to stop drinking. I told her I would, but I did not. My boss, the guy who fired me, told me, please, you know, stop. I can't. I said, I'm going to stop. But I didn't. My physician, who went extra with me, said, we're going to have to commit you. I said, I'll handle it. I fired him as a doctor. I couldn't stop for my career. I couldn't stop for money. I couldn't stop for the love of my family. I stopped for the post office. What does it tell us? What does it tell us? Oh, that sponsor of mine, oh, that rotten man. He was the worst. I would say to him, I don't feel well. He'd say, well, this may be as good as you'll ever feel. I said, well, when will I get a good job? He'd say, yeah, when you're ready. I said, well, how will I know I'm ready? He said, I just told you, I'll have a good job. So it was like dealing with a Zen master, you know? It was all smoke and bubbles and all that stuff. I go to him with stuff in the book. I said, what is the power greater than my own? Don't you think that's a little vague? What the hell is that? Power, and it's a capital. What is? He said to me, yes, he said, a power greater than your own is a power greater than your own. I said, well, is it God? He said, it's a power greater than your own. Well, it's got a capital P. You see, I can see that. Yes, it's got a capital P. He said, look, if they wanted to write God, it's an easy word. They could have written God. It's a power greater than your own. You want to make a God, make a God. Who cares? I would say, I think. He said, don't do that. You're going to hurt yourself. Give yourself some kind of a hernia. Don't ever do that. And he just, I did things. And, well, anyhow, the world has turned over many times since November 24, 1965, and I'm still a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I said, I suspected now. I didn't want to cause trouble. Did not want to make an issue out of something that's not an issue. It's not my way. Don't want to be accused of snobbery or elitism. Big word. That's a college word. But it did seem to me that a number of this group that I was attending in my first years, there were eight of them, and it occurred to me very few of them, if any of them, had attended college. And I told that to my sponsor. He says, you're lucky they have you in a room. I said, well, how many nights a week do I have to hang out with this crowd? He said, yeah, we've talked about that. We think seven ought to do it. Seven means one. I said, geez, that's every night. He said, yes, yes, that's right. You're getting it already. I didn't let him push me around. I went to nine now with him. Now I live in Curie Beach, North Carolina, and I go to six meetings a week. And I think Alcoholics Anonymous, the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is considerable, which is in your life, my life, everybody's life, is in the meetings. It's here with us. It's not in the cars, it's not in the restaurant, it's in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where the power is. And that's what I need, isn't it? That's what I need. I am gonna impose myself on you for a few moments. Lately, I've been reading the correspondence between Bill Wilson and Dr. Carl Jung. If you recall, in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, there is the instance there where Roland Hazard, one of Bill's young friends of great wealth, was sent by his family to be taken care of by Dr. Jung, and he spent a year with Jung, and Jung released him as being cured and all the rest of it. He was drunk a week later, and he was back to Jung. And in our book, Jung really didn't appreciate the fact that Roland was an alcoholic. He was treating him for bipolar, manic depressive, that kind of stuff. And Jung passed a death sentence on Roland Hazard. And he said, "I have never seen an alcoholic of your kind recover. You will go insane and you will die." And Roland said, "My God, isn't there no possible?" "Oh," Jung said, "yes. Once in a while, now and again, here and there, but it's a phenomenon. It's not repeatable. People like you find a religious organization." So Roland has it. It's nice to have wealth. He found the Oxford Group, and he just stopped drinking with the Oxford Group. He moved them all up to Vermont, to Manchester, Vermont, where he had a farm, his family had a farm. He found Abby Thatcher in front of the court, in front of a judge in Bennington, Vermont. He got Abby dry. Abby never really did get sober. And Abby brought the message to Bill. And so Bill, in 1960, on the occasion of our 25th anniversary, wrote a letter to Jung, and he said, "We of Alcoholics Anonymous consider you to be a founder because of the advice you gave to Roland Hazard, who brought it to Abby Thatcher, who brought it to Bill Wilson, who brought it to Bob Smith. And now we are hundreds of thousands of members. We're up to about 3 million now. And we are in X number of countries, I think 144 at the moment." And he got back a very nice letter from Jung, and the letter, first of all, started off a remarkable thing. It said, "I remember Roland Hazard." Imagine, the guy remembers somebody from 1934. This is 1960. All the people Jung might have seen. "I remember Roland Hazard," he said. His problem was that he had separated himself from the whole, W-H-O-L-E, said Jung. In medieval terms, he had separated himself from God. Now, here is one of the greatest psychiatrists, certainly of his time and maybe of all time, a colleague of Sigmund Freud, and it is his opinion that the cause of alcoholism is a separation from God. I find that interesting. We all know that alcoholism is not caused by alcohol. We know that, because you can take the alcoholic out of an alcoholic and all you have there is a very nervous alcoholic. In fact, alcohol is the alcoholic's best friend. Menninger, the great American psychiatrist, says the alcohol is the glue that holds us together. If it weren't for the alcohol, we'd all be jumping out of windows, like Dr. Silkworth says in our book, nervous, irritable, and discontent. They should have taken me from the delivery room to an AA meeting. Right in the basket, put him down there. Look at him, I've been there yelling and screaming, you know. I don't want to be born poor, I don't like this neighborhood, I don't like this goddamn family. I'm gonna kill that, you know, this is the way I was. And of course, I got out of it only because I was that way. So we know the alcohol doesn't cause, the alcohol is what Jung says, it's a separation from God. Now, our book says that there is one who has all power. Remember? There is one who has all power. That one is God. It says, may you find him now. He used to say, you must find him now. Now, if I separate myself from all power, I am powerless. Now, how is it that Bill Wilson and Jung knew these things so many years apart? Where did Wilson get this? Wilson had no information. Jung, of course, had all the information. It seems to me that the controlling power that comes into your life, comes into my life, has made each of us what we are today is God. And I don't think there's any getting around it. And there's certainly nothing to argue about. And don't tell me you don't believe in God, because I don't care what you believe in. We don't have a chapter about that. We don't have a chapter into thinking. You can believe in the flat earth for all I care. But here's what's true in your life. You could not stop drinking. Your life was unmanageable and you were in the toilet. And they brought you here and you didn't want to come here in the first place. And they brought you in here snarling and kicking and yelling and not wanting to be here and knowing every goddamn thing just like me. And here it is X years later and you're in this beautiful place in the Virgin Isles. That's a long, long way from Akron, Ohio, right? And I'm not talking about geography. It's a long, long way from Akron, Ohio. And our book tells us over and over again that this God that I'm talking about, the God of our traditions, he's up there in that wall. Under his maiden name, God. It says, our book says he does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. That's what our book says. He does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. Are these too hard terms this weekend? Are you kidding me? We're in paradise, for Christ's sake. And it says, if, as we draw near to him, he exposes himself to us. Isn't that the way we are in our own relationships, one with the other? You want to know about me? Get my car. You want to know about me? Join my group. You want to know about me? Go to the meetings I go. As you draw near, I'm not going to tell you all about me all at once, but as you draw near, I'll let you know. And I'm not religious. I'm not trying to convert you to anything. I'm not religious. I don't go to, I have nothing against church. I just don't go there. It doesn't interest me. I didn't start out. I came here just to stop drinking. I did not come here to become a spiritual giant or your beloved guru. It just sort of worked out that way. I get the biggest kick out of myself, I'll tell you. Well, whenever I'm finished, I know you don't want me to, but I gotta stop. I always refer to this page. I read this page this morning. I read it every morning. It's the last page of our book. And I hope to God in the fourth edition, not one word is changed in the first 164 pages. I don't care what they do with this other stuff, but this 164, that's written in stone. And we gotta keep our eye on these assholes who wanna make it politically correct. Goddamn things save a million lives, zillion lives, they wanna change it. Don't get me started. Still, you may say, but I do not have the benefit of contract with you who write this book. We cannot be sure. God will determine that. So, you must remember that your real reliance is always upon him. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who still suffers. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you do not have. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and for countless others. And I will consider this weekend as a great event as I go along. This is the great fact, capital G, capital F, for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find. And join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. I have a favorite pamphlet in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's called The Member's View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's the best pamphlet we have, and it's certainly the best written pamphlet we had. And if you're not familiar with this pamphlet, I suggest very strongly you read it. It's just marvelous. And in the last page of it, the author takes a biblical reference, and he recalls the time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons. And John sent two of his friends to inquire of his cousin, Jesus. And these two men found him and they walked with him a while, and one day they stopped him and they said, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the one we've been waiting for all these years, or should we wait for somebody else?" And he never answered that question. He said to them, "Go back to John. And tell John only what you have seen and only what you have heard. Tell John that the blind see and the deaf hear. And tell John that the lame walk and that the sick are made well. And tell John that the poor have the gospel brought to them." In my early training, I was told that the word poor in that context could mean poor in spirit. And everybody knows that the word gospel simply means good news. And so, my dear, dear sisters and brothers, in happy convention in paradise assembled, I will tell you only what I have heard and only what I have seen. And based upon my years in Alcoholics Anonymous and the personal observations I've made, it seems to me that the blind do see and the lame do walk. And I know the deaf can hear, I know that. And most certainly the sick are made well. And I have seen over and over and over again, through the longest day and into the darkest night, the good news of Alcoholics Anonymous brought to the alcoholic who suffers, the poor in spirit. God bless you.